afternoon. It's Tuesday, September 30th, 2003, and coming to you live from WGMU in George Mason University, Fairfax, Virginia, this is Conflict. Good afternoon, and thanks for tuning in for another episode of Conflict. I'm Sean Dunning. Today, our guest is Dr. Amer Abdallah. Dr. Abdallah is a senior fellow with the Peace Operations Policy Program in the School of Public Policy at George Mason University. He is also a visiting professor of conflict analysis and resolution at the University for Peace in Costa Rica and the Graduate School of Islamic and Social Sciences in Leesburg, Virginia. Both his academic and professional careers are multidisciplinary. He obtained a law degree in Egypt in 1977, where he practiced law as a prosecuting attorney from 1978 to 1987. He then emigrated to the U.S., where he obtained a master's degree in sociology and a Ph.D. in conflict analysis and resolution right here at George Mason University. He has been teaching graduate classes in conflict analysis and resolution and has conducted training, research, and evaluation of conflict resolution programs in Egypt, Switzerland, Burundi, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Italy, Rwanda, Ireland, and Iraq. He has also authored and co-authored several research and evaluative teaching manuals, including Doing What You Want With Your Data, A Step-by-Step Guide to Planning and Implementing Evaluative Strategies, and Qualitative Evaluation, The What and Why. Dr. Abdallah has been an active figure in promoting effective cross-cultural messages within the Islamic and Arabic-speaking communities in America and throughout workshops, television, and radio presentations. He has also been actively involved in interfaith dialogues in the United States, and he has also pioneered the development of the first-ever conflict resolution training manual for the Muslim communities in the United States. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Abdallah.
Thank you, Sean.
Well, we certainly have a lot to talk about today. It's very exciting to have you on the program. I understand you recently visited Iraq in Baghdad.
That's correct.
And I thought maybe we'd start off today just by kind of getting some reflections from that visit.
Sure. I was invited to go to Baghdad with an NGO who has a contract with USAID to work on development issues in the neighborhoods of Baghdad. And I was asked to join them as an advisor on conflict issues because of my expertise in the area of conflict resolution and also my knowledge of the Islamic and Arabic culture. So in this context, I joined that group. And I visited Baghdad in July for about 3 weeks. One of the things that people told me before getting to Baghdad was, be careful, it's very hot there. And, of course, having grown up in Cairo, I thought, how hot can it be? But I tell you, once I arrived to Baghdad, I really realized it was really, really hot. I think the temperature there was about 120 degrees.
Wow.
And to look at the soldiers, the American soldiers in full gear in this kind of heat, you really feel, like you empathize with them, mm-hmm. and it was really something. So that was my first reaction, is how hot it was there and how much people probably were suffering, whether the Iraqis or the Americans. Everyone was suffering because of this heat, especially that the Iraqis, of course, did not have consistent water and electricity. Upon arriving in Baghdad, one of the things that really caught my eye quickly was the amount of graffiti written on the walls. Mm-hmm. In the entire city. All this graffiti was written mainly after the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime. And they reflected to a great extent where the people of Baghdad stand on political and social issues. One of the messages that seemed to be very redundant in the on graffitis was a message about the desire to revenge against the Saddam regime and those who worked for the Saddam regime. People obviously mm-hmm. were happy. that Saddam is gone, but also there was so much anger against those who inflicted harm on so many during that time. Also, there was a very strong message about the unity of Iraq. The Iraqi people seemed to insist that they are one nation. They are not going to be divided by religion or by ethnicity. And they seem to be wary that there are groups who have interest in dividing them. And they are working hard to make sure that they maintain their unity. They also seem to emphasize in their graffiti that they seek Islam as their religion to be the refuge and the source of support for how they would pursue the future. They didn't want Saddam Hussein, neither do they want to be occupied at this point by the United States or by anyone else. But instead, they think that they can develop their own unity within an Islamic context. So those were the messages that came clear. I was very interested in many aspects of the conflict in Baghdad. I mean, on one hand, I was there to do my job as an advisor, but I was also, as a conflict resolution specialist, very interested in understanding some of the dynamics, especially the dynamic of the Shiites and Sunnis and how they interact with each other. Are things really bad between the two groups? To what extent can this inflame at one point? And I have to say that my opinion on this issue changed over time. I remember in the beginning when I arrived in Baghdad, I went on a trip with some of my staff to visit one of the Shiite neighborhoods. And we arrived in a health center. And when we arrived there, I saw in the entrance to the health center there was a frame. And in the frame was written in Arabic. And it said something to the effect of a message to a woman saying, like, be modest like a Fatima or a Zainab. I will explain what that means. And do not be decadent like Bani Umayyah. Now, someone who knows Arabic and knows the Islamic culture and history would know that this is so serious. What this really says is a message to a woman saying, be modest and be good like a Shiite. That's pretty much what it says. Do not be bad like a Sunni. That's pretty much what it translates to. And I was just really shocked at that statement, especially that it was posted in a public place where everyone could see it. And I thought that that reflects a serious type of severe conflict. The next day, I also encountered another situation that seemed to also affirm what I saw with that frame. We were driving a car, and there were three people in the car. One of them was a Shiite woman and two Sunni guys. The Shiite woman, when we were driving, she pointed to a mosque that Saddam Hussein was building. It was the largest mosque in the world, by the way. And I was shocked that why did he have to spend all this money to build the largest mosque in the world? And she said, well, that's what he's done. He's been taking our money, the Shiite money, and he would spend it on building his palaces and building mosques for Sunnis. And she went off on Saddam Hussein and what he's done to the Shiites. At that point, one of the people sitting in the car, the two Sunni people, one of them handed me secretly a small piece of paper. And on the paper he wrote, don't listen to her, she is Shia, and I'll tell you more about it. And when we got off the car, he went off on that woman and on the entire Shiite group, how they corrupted their religion, how they don't know what they're doing, they are not patriotic, and so on and so on. So I was very surprised, and I felt that really this is a very serious conflict, much deeper than I thought. However, a couple of days later, that same guy who gave me that small piece of paper came to me and one day and he said, let's go to lunch. We're going to have lunch at a nice place that I know. I haven't been there for years, and it's a very good place. So we went to lunch. And once we arrived there, it was obvious from the pictures on the walls and everything that the owners are Shiites. And once they saw that guy, obviously they have not seen him for some time, they all hugged him and were very happy to see him and greeted him very nicely and gave us very special service. So I said, so explain to me. I mean, the other day you were going off on the Shiites, and then here you come to your favorite restaurant is owned by Shiites, and you seem to have a very good relationship with them. He said, oh, yeah, you got to understand that this is a separate issue. I mean, when it comes to business, when it comes to our personal life, social life, we have no problem interacting with each other. We even intermarry. But when it comes to some of the political issues and some of the religious interpretations, this is where things get a little bit iffy, and we have to be careful.
Yeah, as a conflict resolution specialist, how do you explain that? How in their personal lives, they don't seem to have such division yet when it comes
Yes. You know? I think that my suggestion here is that those people recognized over the years and the centuries that they will never be able to resolve the religious differences that exist between them. One group believes in one thing, the other group believes in something else. And to try to prove one group to be right or one group to be wrong mm-hmm. is going to be impossible. And I think they realized that over the years. And I think once they reached that realization, they found that they need to find a way to live peacefully with each other. And because I think there is more commonality in terms of the religion than differences, they were able to build on that. In addition, other elements of the culture that other than religion, like the traditions and other aspects of their life, mm-hmm. they share with no problem. So I think they were able to build upon other elements of the culture and also on the commonalities that exist in religion and avoid the pieces that can cause trouble between them. Mm-hmm. And to affirm that point, I also discovered that in Iraq, there is a traditional system of clan or tribe that exists, and it is still very strong. And I will tell you more about mm-hmm. it in a few minutes. But those clans, they are made of actually Shiites and Sunnis. So it is not like there are clans for Shiites and there are clans for Sunnis. Mm-hmm. No, the clan can have both. And the clan is not a religious system. It's a traditional system.
Uh-huh.
So I think the existence of other systems like the clan and other and the national identity helped them to find ways to coexist peacefully. I think they have been very successful on the social, personal, and business level. On the political level, the problem was that some political leaders would come and try to exploit the differences, mm-hmm. like Saddam Hussein did.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the religious issues, I think they learned that let's just stay away from the religious stuff because we will never resolve it.
Wow. So say a little more about those clans, though, and how they're organized. Is it geographically? Or?
Great. The clans actually, no, they are not geographic. I was surprised to learn that those clans expand sometimes across nations, similar to what you see in Africa. Like
really?
When you see in Africa, for example, there's mm-hmm. a clan called the Fula. The Fula, they spread all the way from East Africa to West Africa. I think there are 30 million people in that type of clan. Similar to that are the clans in Iraq. I think they spread into Saudi Arabia, into mm-hmm. Jordan, Syria, and Iraq. And people identify with those clans to a great extent. Now, the clan system in general, in the whole Middle East, was influenced negatively by modernization and westernization. That means that to the extent that you find urban areas heavily modernized and heavily westernized, you will find that the influence of the clan is much, much lower, mm-hmm. almost non-existent.
Hmm.
And I think that's what I saw growing up in Cairo especially, that I have not felt that there was an effect for the clan except among the lower socioeconomic groups or the groups that were not as modernized or mm-hmm. westernized like people from the middle class. And also you see them in the villages. But in Baghdad and in Iraq in general, it seems that the system was still much stronger. And what those clans do is they provide some kind of a social support for all who are members of those groups. And I was very surprised actually to see how the members of those clans, they utilize the clan system of conflict resolution to address some of the new issues that are happening right now.
How so?
For example, you know, of course, during Saddam Hussein's time, it was a police state.
Mm-hmm.
By this we mean that if we live in a neighborhood together, mm-hmm. Say that I am, for example, the Saddam Hussein or the Ba'ath Party's guy mm-hmm. in the neighborhood, my job really is to spy and to know what people are doing. And if I'm suspicious that someone is doing something against the regime, I need to report that person. So let's assume that in doing this, I suspected that you or a member of your family is doing something against mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein. So I come and report to the police or to the
right.
intelligence, and they come and pick you up and put you in jail and torture you and so on. Now the Saddam regime is gone, and you know very well that I was the one who got you in trouble or got somebody in trouble. So now it's time for you to revenge. There have been incidents in the last few months where people took justice into their own hands, and they went and killed or hurt those who had hurt them in the past.
Mm-hmm.
There are other situations when I, for example, the Saddam guy, felt that you are coming to hurt me, I would call upon the leader of my clan. By the way, they call it in Arabic in Iraq, Ashira. So I'm going to use the word Ashira from now on to indicate clan. So I called the leader of my Ashira, and I say, please come and do something here because that guy wants to kill me or wants to hurt me or hurt my family because of what happened in the past. So in this case, the leader of this Ashira will contact the leader of your Ashira, and they will have some type of a council where they're going to discuss the issue. And then they start a process that it has been very well established over the years. It's pretty much a process of seeking evidence and seeking the truth, what exactly happened. And it is the responsibility of the person who makes the claim to provide the evidence. And the council would check the evidence and see if it's sufficient. And if they find that I am guilty, then they would declare me guilty. In this case, they take time off. They declare me guilty, but then everyone takes time off for 2 months or so. And then they come back again later with a larger meeting where more Ashira leaders come, and they sit in a process of talking about money, talking about how can we compensate the person who has been a victim. And they go through a fantastic process of bargaining where members of the other Ashiras will try to convince the two parties to come down or come up on their requests for money until they reach a point where it is acceptable for both parties. And the way they do this is by kind of reaching out. For example, say I lived in the neighborhood with you, and I was a leader of another Ashira, and now you are asking for, say, $30 million in compensation. And I know that's too high. So I come to you and say, listen, Sean, this is too much. And remember, when you were in trouble a few years ago, I did help you. So now do me a favor and help this guy. Bring it down a little bit. So here I'm bringing the past, bringing my own favor that I did for you into the bargaining process. And this is what I found to be fantastic, is those people are utilizing approaches that we probably have not thought of carefully in our thinking of bargaining and negotiation.
That history is really important.
Absolutely. History, they bring it into the picture. And also future, because think about it. If I come to you now and say, do me a favor, do it for me, bring the price down a little bit. If you say, no, I'm not going to listen to you, you know that probably in the future I will not listen to you either.
Yeah, so from what I know about bargaining and negotiation theory, whether or not there are potential future interactions really affects how you deal with one. So knowing that they are in that environment together and presumably to stay,
right,
one would think that they would act in the interest that would be best for all of them. But
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. Yeah. I think the community has a strong influence. I sat with a group of leaders of Ashiras to learn from them exactly how the process works. And I asked them to select one case that they actually worked on. And they took that one case where the victim started with requesting 35 million dinars as compensation. And through that process of bargaining and going back and forth, they brought it down to 8 million. And that was the final decision.
What happens, how do they deal with a situation where someone feels like they're wrongly accused? And it comes down to this bargaining, and they may play that game, so to speak, of, agreeing on a figure, but ultimately it's a compromise if one feels that they shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Yeah. I think that as long as the council finds the evidence to be sufficient and declares a person guilty, that's the end of the story.
And everybody tends to respect that?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, perhaps they have a process of appeal or something, but I have not gone that far to understand from them how they do a process of appeal.
Now, is that the actual legal process that's observed by people in that region, or is this something aside from today, everything's nothing's for certain, with all the transitions occurring. But traditionally speaking, even under Saddam Hussein's regime, did these processes occur as the accepted legal procedure, or were they alternative?
That was the alternative dispute resolution model. Of course, they have the state model, which is made of the court system and so on. But this is an alternative approach, but it is acknowledged, of course, and they can take it to the court of law and reinforce it.
Now, as Iraq is under transition right now, and certainly with laws being written and presumably a constitution being designed, and certainly there's a lot of conflict just around that whole process, but do you happen to know of any recognition of this alternative process that you just described? And are they acknowledging that or learning anything from that as they design the new legal system?
I think they acknowledge it, yes. I don't know to what extent the processes that are taking place now are going to take into consideration to promote this system. I hope they do, because I thought that the system was very sophisticated. And also it was able to adjust to the needs of the time. Perhaps what it needs is some refinement, and also to inject it with some of the other approaches that we use here, such as mediation and so on, so that we can make it more appealing to other types of issues and to a wider group of people. I hope that there will be people in the administration who will be thinking in that direction. I can imagine that the fact that many people going from the United States who have been trained in dispute resolution will be working with Iraqis to develop constitutions and to develop other models of legal systems. Perhaps there will be emphasis on the dispute resolution approach. And I think the fact that that dispute resolution approach in Iraq is so widespread, it is not something that you can ignore or you can dismiss and say that's irrelevant or it's archaic. No, it is very prevalent and very effective. And I think people have taken notice of the fact that it has worked well in the last few months to reduce the amount of violence that could have taken place if that system did not exist at the time.
Very interesting. Now, what other roles did you have in this trip with this project?
My role, as I described mainly, was to advise that organization on conflicts that might erupt in their work. Their work mainly was about going to communities and try to understand from those communities what are the issues that they need help with. Like they need help with the sewage problems, which was a very bad problem in most neighborhoods in Baghdad. Trash collection, or, for example, the schools are in bad shape and they need repair. So the representatives of the organization would go there and they meet with members of what they call the neighborhood action committees. Those are committees that were established by the civil military. And they work with them on developing a proposal for what they need and how much and so on. So, of course, there were situations where tension can take place or misunderstandings can happen. And I thought that most of the concerns were mainly about how fast things are being done. I think that the Iraqis have very high expectations that things should happen quickly. And there's the expectation of America, especially, that America has the technology, has the power. So how come they cannot restore water and electricity for us now for 6 months or 4 months or 5 months? There was so much frustration. And I felt that they were so quick to assume the worst. Every time they feel that there is a delay in getting things done, they feel, oh, there must be something else. And they fall back on the conspiracy theory, and they assume that, oh, it must be that the Americans really don't want to help us. They have some other reasons, or they just want our oil, and so on. And I felt that that was really causing so much of the frustration. And until today, I think this is the problem. Very high expectations on the part of the Iraqis. And on the part of the Americans, I think there was not... we didn't anticipate every trouble that we were going to face. So now that we are facing all those difficulties, we seem to adjust a little bit also our expectations. I think what's happening is both groups have to go through an adjustment of expectations. And what will help in this process, I think, is more transparency and more communication, better communication between the Americans and the Iraqis. Otherwise, we will easily fall into the trap of conspiracy theories.
Now, it seems like quite the dilemma. The Iraqis certainly appreciate Saddam Hussein's absence.
Absolutely.
Yet they're certainly frustrated with the United States' presence. And yet they're expecting much from the United States in helping through this transition. So it's a difficult time to be in. I'm going to ask you kind of a difficult question here, and... If you want to pass on it, feel free. But you know, looking back to early this year when the decisions were made in the United States to in fact invade Iraq and go through with the plan, so to speak, which I guess some folks might dispute how much of a plan there actually was. But that aside, you know, I always certainly wondered, and I know many other people in the conflict resolution community wonder about the alternatives to you know, to war? And this is a very kind of large question. Last week we had a former Navy SEAL and modern day cooperative problem solving expert, Tom Dunn. I think you may know who
he
is.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we kind of talked about this a little bit, and, you know, I posed the question, you know, in situations where you have Hitler, you know, is there really another way, or is war the only answer? And I thought this was, you know, maybe not the level of Hitler, maybe not, but certainly it posed an opportunity for us to kind of choose a road, and we chose the road of war, for better or for worse. But in hindsight, and knowing what you know, being, you know, an expert in conflict resolution, being certainly an expert in that region and visiting there recently and getting, you know, hindsight after the war, do you have any kind of, you know, insight into, you know, looking back, could there have been a less violent, less adversarial way to deal with the conflict between the United States and Iraq?
What a difficult question.
I told you.
But I will try to take a hack at it. I think that the issue is very complex. Mm-hmm. For example, like right now, we do not find weapons of mass destruction. And some people are upset about that. And mm-hmm. they say, so why did we go and fight the war? Mm-hmm. But another argument is, wait a minute, this man was a thug and he was horrible. Mm-hmm. And look at all those mass graves and everything he's done to his people. I mean, it is good that we got the world, we got rid of someone like that. So on that level, I mean, I feel that, yeah, someone like this, we don't need a person like Saddam Hussein and his regime to exist. But the problem is people think, well, there are so many others like that. So why pick on that one person?
Right.
And that's where questions are raised about, is it only because of the oil or because of what? I think that perhaps, I mean, of course, the process of war is difficult. And I think that everyone is paying a heavy toll. We are paying a heavy toll. Mm-hmm. We Americans are mm-hmm. paying a very heavy toll now. Iraqis are paying a heavy toll. And looking back, could this have been resolved in a better way? Perhaps, but I think it is setting the stage properly should have taken place first. By this, I mean, since the end of the Cold War, we emerged, the United States, as the only superpower, and we dictate mm-hmm. the rules of the game wherever we go. And we minimize to a great extent the role that other groups can play, United Nations, for example, or the Arab countries in this situation. Mm-hmm. I think if we can empower some of those groups a little bit so that they can play a more effective role, then maybe we can rely on them to help us in situations like this. But we entered the situation of Iraq with minimizing the role of the United Nations, dismissing any role for the Arabs, and we found ourselves in a situation that we were the only one who had to take an action.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that we should have taken a step back and tried to empower some of the other actors so they could do something more effective. And we don't have to find ourselves in a situation where we have to fight that war and end up in a situation right now that it seems that things are very complex and many people are not happy. So my answer to, I guess I'm answering your question with a more complex scenario, which is maybe we could go back and empower the United Nations mm-hmm. again, empower more of the smaller countries mm-hmm. so that they can have a more effective role regionally. I guess that's what I would see as a possibility. We could have done that. It's not too late to do it now. I think actually mm-hmm. it is a prime opportunity right now for the United States to try to empower the United Nations and Arab countries to go and play a role in Iraq. What this will take from us is to perhaps adjust the way we exist in Iraq. The notion of occupation, and I think that's important to mention, is so painful and difficult for the Arab mind.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, as an Arab American, as someone who grew up in the Arab world, I know for sure that all people from the Arab world feel so proud about one thing in the 20th century, which is they were able to get rid of the occupation mm-hmm. by the British and the French.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the national holidays in all the Arab countries are about the day they got rid of the British or the French. Everything since then was downhill for most of the Arab countries, really. But the one thing they feel proud about is we got rid of the colonization and occupation. And it is interesting that in Arabic, when we use colonization and occupation,
mm-hmm.
we use them almost interchangeably. Mm-hmm. We don't stop to think about the difference between the two. So for now, in the 21st century, occupation comes back. The word is so difficult to accept. And I think Arabs have very much of a difficult time accepting it. So I think that if we can a little bit reframe our presence there and try to adjust, even gradually, and allow more of, say, of the Arab League to come in and take more of an active role in bringing independence back to Iraq. And we can still continue to have some type of influence, but not under the umbrella of occupation. Maybe if we can do a gradual process like this, we will be empowering new regional powers to play a role with our cooperation, but at the same time, we don't have to be facing the fire and facing all the criticism that we are facing right now.
Well, let's just hope that we can take this opportunity at this time and do the right thing and as you say, try to make this a more collaborative process with the outside actors, the UN and the Arab League, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a little break now, and when we come back, I'd like to get into talking a little bit about Project Light, which is a very fascinating project that you are leading up that is working towards building understanding with Islam. And particularly, as I understand it, helping to empower Muslims to teach the beauty of their religion to others as well. So we're going to take a little break and come back and talk about that. Good afternoon. You're listening to Conflict on WGMU Radio, coming from George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. I'm Sean Dunning, and today our guest is Dr. Amer Abdallah, and he's a man of great knowledge in many different areas, specifically conflict resolution and the Middle East, specifically Iraq. And we just had some really good conversation about his recent visit to Baghdad and some observations there about some native, if you will, alternative dispute resolution techniques that seem to be quite effective there, and hopefully they'll get worked into the new systems as they develop. Now we're going to switch topics a little bit and talk about a recent initiative of Dr. Abdallah's, and this is called Project Light. And I'll just turn it over to you, Dr. Abdallah, if you could explain to our listeners, what is Project Light?
Thank you. Light stands for Learning Islamic Guidance for Human Tolerance. The idea of this project emerged last year. It's pretty much related to the events after September 11. As we all know, unfortunately, there were incidents when groups of Muslims, Arabs, and people from South Asia were treated improperly. And there were incidents of attacks on some of those people. And as a result, there were several groups in this country who wanted to make sure that this would stop. I have to say that personally, myself as an Arab American and a Muslim American, I was moved and touched by the amount of support I felt personally by my colleagues, my American colleagues and friends, and who came to our support during that time. Every time there was an incident of attack or insult against Muslims or Arabs or people from South Asia, you should see also the amount of support that was coming.
Mm-hmm.
And that would just like make any of those incidents of attack pale by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there were situations when there were groups of Christians and Jews and others who offered to come to the mosques and to build a human shield to protect Muslims when they go to do their Friday prayers. There were also Christians and Jews and others who came and offered to escort our Muslim sisters who wear the head cover mm-hmm. when they go shopping and stuff like that, just to make sure that they are protected. Those acts were really what America stands for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes us really feel proud of being Americans. And it is in that spirit that there were organizations who offered to give grants to do concrete projects to address this discrimination and bigotry against Muslims, Arabs, and people from South Asia. One of them was the National Conference for Community and Justice, NCCJ. They received $1 million from Chevron to do activities related to addressing discrimination against Muslims, Arabs, and people from South Asia. So myself and a couple of other colleagues, we wrote a proposal. We were among 300 people who wrote proposals to get a grant, and only 19 received
money. Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. So we felt so good about it. And again, it just reaffirmed us that we, God bless America, really. I mean, guess that is the bottom line, that you live in a country where here people and organizations and business groups, everyone is trying hard to do something to address issues of discrimination. Because we suffered so much of those issues in this country, and I know that we learned our lesson, and we will never allow this to happen again to any group. So the project that we proposed to do was based on empowering Muslims to understand very well the concepts of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in their own religion. We wanted to make sure that we would bring a group of Muslims from the Washington area, and we gave them very specific intensive education on the concepts of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam, to the point that we make sure that they are completely convinced that this is what Islam is really about.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the first stage of our program. The second stage would be to train this group of Muslims in how to go out and do workshops or outreach meetings with non-Muslim peers to tell them about those messages of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam. Because I feel like we are up against a media that, unfortunately, most of the time, sending a message about Islam that depicts someone like Bin Laden on TV mm-hmm. for 5 minutes and makes people think that this is what every Muslim is or are, and emphasizing that the terror and the violence. And we needed to make sure that people understand that that's not the picture. This is not really what we are, the vast, vast majority of Muslims. Mm-hmm. We are about peace. We are about love. We are about tolerance. And we wanted people to understand how we understand our religion, how we live our religion as Muslims, mm-hmm. as American Muslims. So we selected 40 people who are ordinary people. They are not like experts or scholars or anything. And we made sure that our sample was selected equally among men and women. Also, we have people who are as young as high school age and as old as 70 plus.
Mm-hmm.
All those are in our group. And we did this kind of grounding workshop with them to talk about issues of peaceful coexistence and tolerance in Islam. And that worked very, very well, and it was beautiful. And then we got them to the stage of training them. We divided them into groups of four. So we have 10 teams. Each team mm-hmm. is made of 3 to 4 people. And we train them on a specific curriculum that they can do in about an hour or an hour and a half to address issues of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in Islam. One important element in how we designed our training was to stay away from the boring lecture-type mm-hmm. presentations.
Right.
We knew very well that we as a Muslim community, we need to learn to develop new approaches to communicate messages other than sending someone who would just stand there for half an hour, 45 minutes, just talking. We needed to do something different. Having lived in America, having been around academia for the last 15, 16 years, I have been fascinated by all those new approaches to learning and training, using role plays and using simulations and stuff like this, seem to be very effective in sending messages. So I thought that's what we need to do. So myself and my team, we worked together on developing an hour and a half workshop that is full of fun and activities and interactive things we do and role plays. And during those processes, we communicate those messages to people. And we ultimately finish our workshop by getting together with a group of non-Muslim peers, and we talk about what action plans can we make in order to address issues of discrimination together. So right now, where we are with Project Light is we finished training all our the group of Muslims, and they are all ready to go. We already did one or two workshops, and I think they were received very, very well, and people were pleased with the style and how we did them. And right now, we are ready to go and do 60 workshops. That's what we committed to do. We're going to do 60 workshops in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. We are doing them in high schools, in colleges, in workplaces, in police stations, fire stations, anywhere. Anywhere that there are people who want to listen to this message. We will be glad to go and communicate this message. And also, we want to send it via radio and TV programs like we're doing right now.
Wonderful. You know, just to back up, I have a couple questions about that. How, you know, how did you actually approach these people
that
you selected?
We just advertised the program by email to different websites. We advertised in mosques by the word of mouth. I mean, we used every possible approach to reach out to people, but we made sure that we're going to have a sample that was equal based on gender. For me, that was so important that we are not going to have a predominantly male sample.
Right.
Because that was that's an important thing for us as Muslims. I mean, we know very well that our religion is about equality between gender. Unfortunately, we are misunderstood on this issue, and many people think that we have this patriarchal religion that women stay home and do nothing, and we wanted to break this myth. And one approach for that was to make sure that our team is half men, half women, and every team made of four people is made of two men and two women. So we make sure when we go in groups that people will see men and women working together, because there is nothing wrong with this when it comes to our religion, and we wanted to make sure that people see that. If there is someone like Bin Laden or someone like the Taliban who think that women should not work, should not actively be engaged in the community, that's their problem, and I use that word, their problem. But we, the vast majority of Muslims, we believe in the role of women and their active role in the community.
So, for instance, that is one topic or issue that can be enlightened upon right there, the role of women in Islam. What other types of lessons are intended to come out of this?
Excellent. As the other important lesson is the universality of Islam. By this we mean that Islam was intended as a religion to spread to all over the world, not just to one specific ethnic group or racial group. In addition, we don't assume in Islam that everyone has to be a Muslim to be a good person. We have very strong commands in our religion telling us that it is not our business to convert people or to change people or to make people like us. As a matter of fact, this is what we call God's domain. This is a very important principle that we try to highlight in our workshops, is that the principle of God's domain means that only God can change people or can make people believe one way or the other. But it is not my job as a human being to force someone or to make someone believe in one way or the other. Our job is simply just to clarify who we are, explain who we are. Who is going to come our way or not come our way, that's not our business. So, and who is going to be in hell, who's going to be in heaven, this is also not our business. And we cannot judge that. So those principles are so important for us to clarify and to make it clear to our own people and also to people around us, to understand this universality of Islam and our belief that there is something called God's domain that we human beings cannot share with God.
Well, what kind of motivations do you find within the participants for why they have chosen to do this? I presume they're volunteering?
As a matter of fact, no. As a matter of fact, we are giving them a very small monetary incentive to participate, which we think that, I mean, living here in America, you know, I mean, time is money.
Sure.
And we thought it was not fair for to bring people and have them spend long weekends and trainings and then go out and do 1.5 hour workshops 6 times in the next 6 months. And we thought that it's only fair to compensate them, especially for the young ones. I was very interested in encouraging the high school kids, especially, to come to the program and feel that they are earning money doing something good. So we give them a small monetary. But the main incentive and motivation for the group is really that everyone realizes that since September 11 and before that, there has been a lot of misunderstanding about Islam and that we needed to do something. Everyone as a Muslim feels that he or she wants to do something to explain ourselves better. So Project Light provides a platform that is conducive to people coming together, thinking together, and working collaboratively to develop this approach, and then going out as a group and doing this kind of presentation.
So that, I guess that kind of answers my next question. As I think about this, I imagine, if I understand this correctly, the trainers, the members of this project, will hold meetings with other interested non-Muslim peers.
Correct.
And to get, and it's not about just talking to those non-Muslim peers. It's about them together working to seek solutions, to put their heads together and find out, you know, how can we get this word out even more. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think what we did is we developed the lesson plans during the workshops to move the group of non-Muslims from, number one, to understand the universality of Islam, to then to understand also the principles of peaceful coexistence and tolerance in Islam, and then to move to understanding the diversity among Muslims today in America, that we are not all that one Bin Laden guy, but we are diverse. We are diverse ethnically. We are diverse in terms of nation, in terms of many age, you name it. And then finally, we reach a point of where we talk together about action plans to address discrimination, whether against Muslims or against others. How can we work together? What would be the proper things to do to address discrimination?
How are these members trained to deal with the tough questions that I would imagine will probably come out, such as, okay, I understand this is the kind of majority understanding of Islam, but what about those who are the extremists and claim to be, you know, Islam, you know, Muslim? They are there.
Excellent, excellent. And actually, that's usually the last part of our workshops is the question and answer. And what we did is we wanted to have some uniformity for how our group will be able to respond to those questions. We came up with a very creative approach where we, of course, having lived here for so long, many of us, we know what kind of questions come to us from our non-Muslim friends and brothers and sisters. So we listed all those questions, and then we thought about what are the different frameworks that apply to different questions. And we came up with about 8 or 9 frameworks that seem to capture any kind of question. For example, if you ask me a question, say, is it true that in Islam only Muslims going to heaven? In this case, we apply the framework, we call it God's domain. By this we mean that I don't know. It's not my job to say to anybody, you're going to heaven or you're going to hell. It's God's domain. So that becomes a framework that applies to this question. It comes to a question like you say, what about those people who believe that we should kill everybody who is not Muslim and all that stuff? And here we use a different approach where we can talk about something called Islamic value parameters. By this we mean that Islam has clear parameters that you cannot violate. One of them is you cannot kill innocent people under no circumstances. And anyone who does that, I don't care in the name of religion or in the name of what, is guilty of committing a crime. But in addition, another approach to it is the kind of different interpretations that exist within any religion, not just Islam. By this I mean someone like Bin Laden and those groups, they have their own interpretations, similar to someone like Timothy McVeigh. When you think about it, he probably had his own interpretations of religion. The KKK have their own interpretations that have religious groundings, and so on. That does not mean that this is the proper interpretation. I think the majority don't agree that those are proper interpretations. So the same thing exists with, in Islam, within Islam. We have groups that unfortunately they think that they have monopoly over righteousness and the truth, and they think that this is the right interpretations, and they cause so much damage not only to non-Muslims but to Muslims as well. As a matter of fact, more Muslims were killed on the hands of those fanatic groups in the Middle East than non-Muslims. Hmm. I mean, when I worked in Egypt as a prosecutor, I was prosecuting many of those people who participated in religious fanatic groups like Islamic Jihad and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And President Sadat was killed, and he was a Muslim guy.
Right.
Many people were killed on their hands, and that was also in the name of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's their own interpretations, and we need to make it clear that they don't reflect mm-hmm. the majority by any means.
So clearly you're working towards providing a balanced understanding of what the majority feel and what the majority understanding is of Islam. Did you, I'm wondering, in these workshop training sessions with the original 40 selected people, where did you face any difficult conversations about, you know, those relative perspectives on certain topics?
Absolutely.
And how did you deal with that?
Yes. Imagine, I mean, I think if you bring any group, a religious group, I don't care if it's a Muslim or Jewish or Christian mm-hmm. or Hindu or Buddhist, and to try to bring it together to consensus on a framework or an hour and a half workshop mm-hmm. that's going to use to present the religion, you're going to have different points of views. And we did have issues like this. And it was fascinating. I mean, I think it was a very positive process. Sometimes it was tiring, but I think we all learned from this process. There were issues that were raised and that we decided that we need to honor, that on this item people are not agreeing fully, so we need to dismiss that item because we don't want people to say something that they don't feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Others, we had to compromise a little bit on the wording and how mm-hmm. to present it and so on. But yes, we had. But how we did this, I think we, myself and the team, the Project Life team, we thought that we were a role model in the situation.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted people to understand that we are not here to impose opinion on people, but we developed an open forum where when we did something and people objected to it, we listened and we said, okay, let's understand this point. And we tried, we used our conflict resolution ICAR stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that worked very well. And we were willing to take off some points. Like, I remember one question that we had in our quiz was something about, like, Buddha was probably a prophet according to Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And you could argue that, on one hand, yeah, probably according to how the Quran is written, Buddha could be a prophet. But someone else had a valid argument that probably not, because Buddha did not establish the unity of God and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
which is the fundamental concept in Islam, so he couldn't be a prophet of God. So we thought that that was becoming a very controversial issue, and therefore we decided not to keep that one question mm-hmm. in our quiz. So what this did to that one person who brought a different argument, different from ours, is that he realized that we actually listen. And we actually make changes if we think that it is something important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people started to have this kind of trust. We had other also difficulties with some of the processes. I told you that the community, the Muslim community in general, is not very used to using approaches like role plays and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So part of what we do in our workshop is we have a role play where we have a group of Muslims coming together before the month of Ramadan to talk about how to plan Ramadan activities during the month of Ramadan. And they differ on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if you bring a group, I guess, of Christians in a church talking about how we're going to plan the Christmas
right,
this year.
Right, everybody has their own traditions. And
you got it, yeah. So what we try to accomplish with this work, role play, is to show people that we are different like you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we are different, but that's similar to what you have in your family or in your mm-hmm. church or your synagogue or temple.
Mm-hmm.
And some of our colleagues in the group were not comfortable at all. They said, we look so bad like this. We look like we differ and argue, and we don't want to look like that.
Oh, gee, you mean they're human.
Yeah. That's what was the point. But some people still were very nervous about looking bad. I mean, don't forget, mm-hmm. we are, as a Muslim community, we are very sensitive
right.
to, we're getting so much of bad media, so don't mm-hmm. add injury to the, what, how do you say that? Injury to the soul or wound to the soul, one of those
insult
things.
Insult injury, right, right.
And anyway, but what we did actually to resolve this issue is we brought a group of non-Muslims
mm-hmm.
and we had them sit during our rehearsal and asked them to give us their opinion on that role play.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, that was fantastic, the group of non-Muslims. They said, that was great. We liked it. It really showed us that you guys like us. I mean, it achieved its goals.
Uh-huh.
So in doing this, that was another approach that we used that kind of like made everyone agree that, well, if the recipients of this workshop
mm-hmm.
are happy with it and they think it accomplishes its goal, then we can need to put our differences aside.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very actually effective approach that we used, was to bring in Muslims to give us their opinion on it.
Very good.
Yeah.
You know, you, Dr. Abdallah, are an expert on evaluative processes, et cetera, you've authored a few books on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, is there an evaluative component to this particular project? Do you have a plan for somehow gauging the success of it?
Absolutely. We have different levels of evaluation. We have a whole evaluation team. We have our Project Light team divided into two groups. There is a training team, and this is the team that I head. And then there is an evaluation team that is headed by my co-principal investigator. And what they do is they evaluate first the process of how we select people and how we bring people into the project. And then we have outcome evaluation measures where we're going to look at how people are learning some of those concepts that we introduce in our workshops. And then we're going to have long-term impact evaluation where we're going to contact some of those who participate in our workshops. And we would talk to them about the action plans that they developed during the workshop and see if they have used actually any of those actions in the past few months or if they know of other people who have used them. So, yes, so we do have a very strong evaluation component based on measuring process, outcome, and impact as well.
Well, we certainly look forward to hearing about those results. And this will be wrapping up when?
It's going to end the end of March. I think we're going to ask for an extension, a no-cost extension, in order to make sure we accomplish all 60 workshops. So probably I think we're going to go through the spring of 2004.
Fascinating. Well, hopefully we can perhaps get a checkup from you maybe in a month or so, see how it's going.
Oh, absolutely.
Possible? Great. Love to hear how it's going along, and I'm sure it's going to be a work in progress, and you'll learn many things along the way as well.
Well, I'd be glad to come back, and thank you, Sean.
Well, we're out of time today, folks, and I want to thank our guest, Dr. Amar Abdallah. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sean.
And next week, tune in to Conflict on Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. to hear a new program on cultural conflict and Western medicine. We're going to hear from Dr. Thomas Resk, who is a medical examiner pathologist in California, who's been working to create some dialogue in the Hmong community around the topic of what are autopsies. And sounds very kind of out there, but actually some very fascinating lessons to come out of this. And in the studio, we're going to be joined by Dr. Linda Johnston of the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution right here at George Mason University. And she's an expert on medicine and medical conflict and cultural conflict as well. So should be a very interesting program. If you have any questions you'd like to submit ahead of time, feel free to send them to questions@conflictradio.org. And if you have any comments from today's program, please send them to comments@conflictradio.org. And one last email address, if you have any ideas about future programs, any suggestions on what you might like to hear about here, please send them to ideas@conflictradio.org. I'm Sean Dunning. Thank you so much for tuning in.